A review from the Inspector General in 1963 added, quote, "A final phase of the testing of MKUltra products places the rights and interests of U.S. citizens in jeopardy." Yeah, understatement of the century.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad to be getting behind the microphone and heading off into another week as we go in pursuit of the enigmatic like we do every Monday night from 8 until 10 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. So let's lock in. Bright flashes have been lighting up the sky over parts of the United States. Also, there are developments in the world of archaeology, as well as paleontology, and of course, exobiology, one of our all-time favorite subjects on this program. But as we near the heart of the conversation this week, we're going to be exploring the human mind, and more importantly, the concerning efforts by U.S. intelligence agencies in decades past to try and hack the mind. That's right. Can a Manchurian candidate be made? Well, of course, the results of the experiments carried out by intelligence agencies would tell us no. But we're going to explore the sordid history of mind hacking this week. That's right. MK Ultra is on the table. So, lots to get into as always. I hope everyone is doing great out there. Always good to be able to join you guys here as we fill up our coffee mugs and dive right into a conversation. You know, I guess it warrants mention here. I try not to talk about politics on this show, and this isn't political, so before you change the channel, before you switch to another podcast, you know, when news breaks, I always say we have to acknowledge that, and of course we had tremendous news over the last few days with the announcement that the President of the United States and the First Lady had contracted COVID-19. Now, presently, there is a tremendous amount of confusion and debate about this, but all signs appear to be showing, as of the time of this broadcast, that he is doing well and he is on the up and up. And this is one of those times, I think, that really we put politics aside and we recognize nobody at such a pivotal time in not just American history, but really in world history. Nobody wants to see us descend further into the flames of chaos. And so I send well wishes to the POTUS and also to the First Lady. And to try and put a historical spin on things, I am reminded here of the assassination attempt against former President Ronald Reagan. And when he was in the hospital and the surgeons were at work, one of them had said, you know, today we're all Republicans. And really what he meant is, when things like this happen, we are all human beings. And we are all stronger when we stand together. Regardless of politics, religious views, belief, or skepticism, you know, come on, we all have a whole lot in common when we just look at the fact that we are human beings sharing this little mud ball island home floating out here in the cosmos. And I think it's important, it is healthy, in fact, to remember that. So, with that, of course, sending well wishes not only to those in Washington who have been affected, but also to everybody else out there. I hope everyone is happy, everyone is healthy. And however you're celebrating the season as we head into autumn, I hope you guys are all happy out there above all else. You know, I wanted to touch on this story that Lauren Sinalong, always doing the finest job curating the news for us on a weekly basis. She and others, like Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, Adam Olson, a lot of you guys, and of course, you know, I pick a lot of those stories too. But this one that Lauren selected for us is a great one to lead off with, because stepping out into the cool mountain air over the last few nights, it was clear enough to be able to see almost into infinity. It's interesting, when you stand outside on a clear night and you look at the sky, we often think of ourselves as looking up. But in space, my friends, there is no such thing as up or down. Isn't that fascinating? When you are standing in your yard looking at the stars, you actually are looking out. You may be able to see planets, you'll certainly see stars, you might be able to see the Milky Way on a really clear night and if it's dark enough where you are. And that's always the most humbling experience for me, which really, in truth, ties into what we were just talking about with our opening announcement or acknowledgement about the current state right now with the POTUS. Yeah, a great way to put yourself in the grand scheme of things and remember how small you really are and how little we as Earthlings actually may be is to stand out on any clear night and look out into space. And remember, there is no up or down out there, ladies and gents. And so, over the last few nights, I have taken the opportunity that the clear skies have offered, as I tend to do, backyard astronomer that I am. And some of you guys may have also seen some of the bright flashes that have been making news. That's right, U.S. News out of Pittsburgh reporting here that a bright flash of this sort lit up the skies over parts of Pennsylvania and Ohio last Wednesday. Although this one, they say, officials aren't really sure what it was. Now, normally, it's a bolide or a meteor that's producing a light as it is entering Earth's atmosphere, burning up as it passes through. A security camera in New Lyme, Ohio, northwest of Pittsburgh, captured a brief bright flash partially obscured by clouds. This would have occurred at around 4:20 a.m. local time. But apparently the National Weather Service then said that it was aware of no reports and had no additional information. Officials at the University of Pittsburgh's Allegheny Observatory also did not immediately comment. So what had been the source of this bright flash? Well, there are a lot of different things in nature that can cause this. Sometimes you have sheet lightning, you know, upper atmospheric lightning storms and things that can cause a bright flash, and sometimes also in the absence of any thunder or anything, especially in cooler weather. But if I had to guess, I would say it was probably a meteor behind the clouds. Again, they note that it was partially obscured, and overcast sky made it difficult to determine what the source of the flash could have been. But safe it to say, really, I think what we're dealing with here is a UFO, right? An unidentified flashing object, right? Hey, that still works. You know, heading across the ocean and over to Egypt, we also have the following story, and a few of you guys had taken the time to send this one along. Archaeologists in Egypt say that they have discovered 59 sealed wooden coffins. They believe these were buried more than 2,500 years ago, and they are in a very good state of preservation. Al Jazeera reports here that opening one of the ornately decorated sarcophagi before assembled media on Saturday, the team revealed mummified remains wrapped in a burial cloth that bore hieroglyphic inscriptions in bright colors. Guys, let me stop you right there. It's 2020. You don't open sarcophagi in 2020, right? In fact, some would argue that where we are right now had been the result of previous openings and unmaskings of the interiors of sarcophagi. Yeah, so guys, really, you're playing with fire here. But anyway, all archaeological jokes aside, they note that this find was unearthed south of Cairo in the sprawling burial ground of Saqqara, the necropolis of the ancient Egyptian capital of Memphis, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. According to Mustafa Waziri, Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, he says, "We are very happy with this discovery." And so am I. I'm always happy when there are archaeological discoveries like this. I just hope, of course, that opening it won't only make the situation we're already in worse, right? I am just kidding, ladies and gents. I don't want to get an email from somebody saying, "You and your anti-scientific inclination toward the mystical." Hey, you know, come on, you can make a joke sometimes, right? In fact, right now, I would argue maybe we need a few more of those. I hope you guys had, by the way, a good Catterday over the weekend. There's a big story right now, PhysOrg reporting that a small team of researchers in Budapest say they have observed an instance where a house cat recognizes and then mimics human behavior. The group has written a paper describing their observations and published it in the journal Animal Cognition. The reason I always laugh when I read stories like this is because, yes, I understand, under laboratory conditions, it's a different thing to recognize something and to make a discovery with actual demonstrable evidence in support of it. I get it. But I'm laughing because everybody at home who owns a cat or has ever owned a cat knows that what they are confirming now in a laboratory is something we cat owners have all known all along, isn't it? You know, my beloved, the late but very great Miss Nikki. She was my little companion, favorite fuzzball of many years. And we lost her a couple of years ago, but longtime listeners of the program may recall a few instances where there would be a little yammering in the background and suddenly the audible sound of her purring as she leapt into my lap when she had hidden under a couch in the studio and managed thereby to infiltrate the bunker during live broadcasts over the years. Yes, this has happened more than once. But one of the most astonishing things that Nikki did was, again, unlike dogs, cats, generally, you can't train them to fetch. You don't teach them to do things and to follow commands. And I remember I had gone book hunting. I've told this story a few times before. On the occasion in question, I'd gone book hunting, and I was trying to find a receipt for the books I had just bought from a used bookstore. And I was jokingly saying aloud, talking more to myself than to my wonderful little four-legged furry friend, "Nikki, help me find that receipt. I can't find the receipt for the books that we just bought." And lo and behold, I look over, and this is no exaggeration, the cat has the receipt in her mouth and brings it over to me and places it on the bed in front of me. And that was one of the most truly shocking and also delightful things I've ever experienced, because I'm thinking, how in the world could you possibly have understood what I was talking about? And so my working hypothesis thereafter was that the cat was actually some kind of alien life form, which led to the further hypothesis that really, if indeed an alien invasion ever had occurred, it would have been that. That's right, the aliens simply would have taken the form of cats and been really cute like they are, and then they are, rather than having to invade or infiltrate our Earth and our societies, all they have to do is just sit there and look cute, and then they are invited in, they're given free food, free water, they're petted all the time, they are treated like royalty for doing virtually nothing. You know, that's the way that you achieve an alien invasion. But, again, I've often thought that our animal friends, if you are an owner of a pet and you're really close with that animal, you do realize that they are able to interact with you in ways that often are overlooked in terms of our scientific understanding. They note here at PhysOrg, very few species have been observed imitating human behavior. Only orcas, apes, elephants, dolphins, magpies. Guys, really, you said very few. How long is this list? But now they say that list has grown to include house cats because the finding comes as a surprise, as cats were not thought to possess the necessary cognitive abilities to intentionally mimic the actions of other creatures. Well, think again, ladies and gents. But again, I will maintain, I don't know that that's all that surprising. Newsworthy though it is, I don't think it's all that surprising to a few of us out here. Now, moving from the area of zoology over into paleontology here for a moment. This is a really interesting one that Lauren brought to my attention, having to do with one of my favorite varieties of dinosauri, the Archaeopteryx. Many of you will remember this as being a, well, believed to have been a feathered dinosaur. But the latest news involving Archaeopteryx is now bringing into question the presence of feathers. That's right, a new study now is providing substantial evidence that the first fossil feather ever to be discovered does belong to Archaeopteryx, debunking a recent theory that the fossil feather originated from a different species. Now, a bit of background. Archaeopteryx, bird-like, but nonetheless a dinosaur, was discovered way back in 1861 in Germany. And the new research published in Scientific Reports, they say, finds that this Jurassic fossil matches a type of wing feather called a primary covert. Primary coverts, by the way, overlay the primary feathers and help to propel birds through the air. This international team of scientists led by the University of South Florida analyzed 9 attributes of the feather in question, particularly the long quill, along with data from modern birds. They also examined the 13 known skeletal fossils of Archaeopteryx, 3 of which do possess these primary coverts. The researchers discovered that the top surface of an Archaeopteryx wing has primary coverts that are identical to the isolated feather in size and shape. Now, that isolated feather that they're talking about, apart from the primary fossil remains, was nonetheless from the same fossil site as 4 skeletons of Archaeopteryx. But lead author Ryan Carney, he's assistant professor of integrative biology there at USF, he chimed in on this, and I want to quote him here. He says, "There's been debate for the past 159 years as to whether or not this feather belongs to the same species as the Archaeopteryx skeletons, as well as where on the body it would have come from and what its color would have been. Through scientific detective work that combined new techniques with old fossils and literature, we were able to finally solve these centuries-old mysteries. Now, this really excites me because when you are putting new scientific techniques toward the resolution of an old mystery, that's always going to help you, but often what you find is that such new technologies are nonetheless reliant on available existing data. Some of that data actually can be quite old. And there are new discoveries that are made, for instance, in the field of history, even regardless of the way that it complements discoveries in the sciences. But this raises a really interesting question about whether history is a science. And that leads us to a rather interesting anecdote from Cambridge.org, where they note that if history is a science, it's a rather special sort of science, but if it is to be considered as a form of literature, it is also a very special form of literature. History is different from the sciences insofar as it is very difficult to speak of scientific progress. But really what that seems to say, above all else, is that history is a very unique form of inquiry. No, it isn't necessarily scientific, but obviously a historian can be very scientific in the way that they go about conducting historical inquiry, and historical inquiry can certainly be useful in determinations made in the other sciences. Then you've got other areas of science which are called historical sciences, right? Anthropology and other branches that fall into that area, which really only furthers my point, how useful history can be in making scientific discoveries. But that really excites me because one project I'm working on right now is trying to lay the foundation for whether or not historical inquiry can teach us things about a subject like Sasquatch. Again, it may be hard for us to say that there is direct evidence throughout history in the historic record of creatures like what Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum calls relict hominoids. And trust me, when you actually go back and you look at what some put forward as historical accounts involving Sasquatch, most of them are anything but. It really shows how careful people need to be, although they often aren't, in the way that they interpret historical accounts that might qualify for this kind of a creature. But it is equally true that if such creatures exist today, let's go out on a limb and say that Sasquatch might be a physical flesh and blood biological reality. Well, then it would be true, then, also, that there must also be representations of their presence throughout time in the historic record. Barring, of course, the possibility that these are interdimensional beings that use telepathic mind speak to communicate with various select humans, a rather improbable possibility, which nonetheless I find a troubling number of people ascribing to these days. No, I say, in that great tradition of, if people are saying that they are seeing what appears to be a zoological phenomenon, then let us proceed with the assumption that that is what it is, however wary it may be, however capable it may be of evading humans, and, of course, demonstrating tremendous success at doing so over the years. But really, how successful has it been? Again, there's a great book by Chad Arment, titled Historical Bigfoot, where he relies mostly on North American newspapers to bolster the case that there have actually been many sightings. These creatures are not as good at evading humans as people have tried to argue at times, and further, they also have been represented in the historical record, at least in North America, well in advance not only of Bigfoot making a splash back in the 1950s with the Ray Wallace hoax, look at our episode from a few weeks back about that, but also well in advance of many discoveries in modern primatology that include such discoveries as the mountain gorilla. And why that's significant is that prior to the discovery of various known kinds of extant hominoids, we nonetheless had descriptions of similar things, which in advance of those discoveries were more often called wild men or things like that, rather than gorilla, as the term became popular only after the discovery of these species. But that's right, those earliest reports that seem to describe something like Sasquatch nonetheless convey anatomical details that are consistent with what we now know of various extant hominoids. Now that to me is really interesting, but the reason I bring all that up in relation to this discovery about Archaeopteryx is because in both cases, I would argue that history and proper historical inquiry may actually help to resolve a scientific problem. We've done that with Archaeopteryx. Maybe that could be applied toward other areas of interest too, some which, according to many scientists, fall outside of the scope of what scientists should be inquiring about. which to me is, frankly, a rather silly statement. Again, if we lead with the presupposition that something like Sasquatch is a myth, and therefore we can resolutely say there's nothing to be studied, what happens if it turns out this was an actual real creature? No wonder we never were able to put a finger on it, because nobody was willing to look at it except for those people who often lack scientific credentials, lack the kind of funding of academic organizations, who lack the kind of training and the kind of coordination that is necessary on part of biologists, and really in all branches of the sciences, to resolve a great question like this. No wonder this creature, if it exists, has managed to evade us. We keep pretending it doesn't exist. And maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But again, I don't think we should lead with that presumption. Nothing should be something that science doesn't look at. That's just a silly proposition. And here again, as we wrap up our news segment, I'll make the assertion that it's very unique to me that there could be life on Earth that scientists are more than happy to ignore, and actually proudly state their reasons for ignoring it. Whereas, we see so much interest and attention being put toward the UAP problem, and also the search for alien life. We don't know what UAP is, or whether it might even have any relation to the latter, and we certainly have not found evidence yet of alien life. And yet, more and more scientists appear to be going all in on both of those, and yes, some, I think, are also making tentative connections between the two, actually. If we're going to be honest, they have been for decades. But as far as the actual search for alien life goes, we've got the following piece that Lauren sent along here from over at space.com by Megan Bartels. And she writes that the European Space Agency has launched its characterizing exoplanet satellite nicknamed CHEOPS. Gotta love that, all you fans of Egyptology out there. And this actually occurred back in December, but the spacecraft began science observations only as recently as April of this year. And CHEOPS, we should note, isn't designed to discover alien planets, but rather to inform scientists so that they can construct portraits of these worlds. And so scientists are very excited because CHEOPS has created its first detailed portrait of a world, and it's a weird one. It's hot, and it's tilted around a warped star. That's right. Now this planet, WASP-189b, was first detected back in 2018. According to an ESA statement, this first result from CHEOPS is hugely exciting. That according to Kate Isaac, who is a project scientist for CHEOPS over there at the ESA, it is early definitive evidence that the mission is living up to its promise in terms of precision and performance. You know, one can only imagine that with the kinds of scientific efforts underway presently to try and search for whether life exists out there, in the next few years, without question, we're going to find it. I mean, if it's out there, it's just a matter of time before we discover life on other worlds. But wouldn't it be ironic if there were life here on Earth that, again, we weren't willing to look at in favor of our efforts to try and find it out there? There are a lot of mysteries about this planet. Not to be saying we shouldn't look for alien life. No, I completely stand behind that too, but we should not forget that there may be life here on Earth as well. Hey, I saw a Reddit thread the other day. This is kind of cool. The folks over on the Bigfoot Reddit have now caught wind of the fact that the guys and I are doing a Sasquatch-themed podcast. That's right, there was a new thread up over on the Bigfoot Reddit saying, Micah Hanks has got a new Sasquatch-themed podcast, and a few people were raising their eyebrows because one of the first comments, which had, I'll note, gotten a lot of upvotes, said that with his usual skepticism, Micah is putting together a fine podcast about Sasquatch. Hey, by the way, no man is an island. Jeff and Smo have been helping out with that. I've got some of the finest co-hosts in the business, especially when you add to that Jason and James over on the Seven Ages Audio Journal. If you are new to my podcast here, and you're unaware that I produce others, head on over right now to MicahHanks.com/shows. That is the quick link that I've put up where all the shows can be found. But we've got links to all of those at their respective websites. You click one of those podcast icons right there, it will take you where you've got to be. Subscribe today. Lots of listening to catch up on, my friends. All right, when we return, we will be diving into the history of mind control here on the Micah Hanks Program. People around the world were on edge. The war was over, but the conflict had only just begun. Although really, in the years immediately after World War II, nobody knew if the war was over or not. The battle had only ended, but how long before the world superpowers of Russia and the United States were right back into the thick of it? And with the advent of nuclear weapons, devastating devices of war which, by now, weren't exclusive to the Americans, what would the outcome be this time if the world went back onto the battlefield? The Cold War years pitted us against silent enemies, moving unseen and maybe even in our midst. Often we never really knew if enemies of the U.S. were hidden among us, watching our every move and reporting on their spying activities back to their leadership in the Red East. The thought alone that there could be spies hidden among us was concerning enough, but by June 1953 we had proof of it, following the arrest of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, a couple that were convicted and later executed on grounds of a conspiracy to pass U.S. atomic secrets to the Soviets. Were there others here like the Rosenbergs? And if communists weren't here on American soil already, using everything from spiritualism to flying saucer cults as covers for their subversive operations to lure U.S. citizens into their ideologies, then certainly countries like the Soviet Union, China, and North Korea were at work trying to brainwash prisoners in their own countries. What if they managed to do it? Could something like mind control actually be achieved? And if so, to what end? We had no way of knowing, really, whether our Cold War enemies were doing this or not, and that wasn't a chance that we were willing to take. Because if your enemies have something, you'd better have it too. And if they don't have it, you'd better get it first. So our story of the government's quest for mind control actually begins during the heat of the Second World War. Over the years, troves of information have been released by the Central Intelligence Agency, both in the form of declassified documents, as well as official histories on the operations of intelligence agencies since the early years of their formation. According to one historical narrative featured at the CIA's website, quote, on July 11, 1941, President Roosevelt established the Office of the Coordination of Information, or the COI, unquote, at which time it named William Wild Bill Donovan as its director. From this moment forward, the history reads, Donovan became known as the father of American intelligence. Donovan, who was a war hero, had already served on several different federal commissions and had even run for lieutenant governor in New York, which made him a natural pick for the role. According to the CIA's historical documentation, the COI was tasked with coordinating information collected abroad for the president. After the United States became involved in World War II, the COI became the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, in June of 1942, with Donovan still in charge. The OSS, according to the CIA, consisted of men and women from many areas and backgrounds: lawyers, historians, bankers, baseball players, actors, and businessmen. Their assignment was to conduct espionage, sabotage, and morale operations against the Axis powers, and conduct in-depth research and analysis on the nation's enemies and their capabilities. Donovan was a fearless leader and became known for saying, "Let's give it a try." Hardly the worst catchphrase that would be attributed to various leaders in the intelligence agencies from over the years, as we will see. The OSS was instrumental in many of the successes during World War II, including providing the U.S. government with advance information about German efforts to develop atomic weapons and the plot to assassinate Hitler. Now, about those catchphrases, here's one for you. Throw all your normal law-abiding concepts out the window. Here's a chance to raise merry hell. These were the words of Stanley P. Lovell, a Boston chemist and the man Donovan would nickname Professor Moriarty, after the famous nemesis of Sherlock Holmes. According to another CIA history, quote, whenever possible, Donovan wanted OSS to rely on its own resources. To that end, he directed the establishment of the Research and Development, or R&D, branch on the 17th of October, 1942. He made an inspired choice to head the branch, The self-described saucepan chemist, inventor, and entrepreneur from Boston, Stanley P. Lovell. As Lovell put it after the war, he quickly understood that the OSS needed, quote, its own special arsenal of tools and weapons, and that only research and development was capable of creating such an arsenal. You see, you might liken the R&D branch to the Q branch in the James Bond films. I'm not the only person, by the way, to make that comparison. And this, of course, is where 007 goes and gets his special spy gadgets before every mission. Well, much the same, the R&D branch developed special weapons and equipment for the OSS, and according to CIA historians, Lovell's own skills, bolstered by his network of contacts in government and private industry, assured OSS Director Donovan that those intelligence officers going into the war zones possessed the best and newest collection, communication, and sabotage technology. Lovell returned to the private sector after the war, but he left quite a precedent for the CIA to build on, and stayed in touch with OSS veterans who went on to found the CIA. At Lovell's suggestion, the director of plans, Alan Dulles, created the Technical Services Staff, a separate, well-funded, and well-staffed unit responsible for technical support in the fledgling agency. Now that name, too, Alan Dulles, is no doubt one that's familiar to many listeners. He eventually went from director of plans to being the director of what became known after the war as the Central Intelligence Agency. It had been in response to the concerns about brainwashing that might be underway in nations like the Soviet Union that caused Dulles to approve, in 1953, what became known as MK-Ultra. It was an operation aimed at development of methods for use against the Soviets, aimed at controlling behavior of human beings through psychological manipulation and, where necessary, or simply more efficient, the implementation of mind-altering drugs. The problem was that although MK-Ultra had been developed as a weapon in the toolbox for use against the Soviets, the actual targets of the program and its research became unwitting American citizens. Involving hundreds of clandestine experiments to gauge the potential use of mind-altering substances for purposes of mind control, interrogation, and even psychological torture, for 2 decades, the program ran secretly from its inception in 1953, only becoming public knowledge in 1975, and that, after a congressional investigation we will hear more about later, finally began to look into illegal activities being undertaken by the CIA, and those activities, mind you, both on U.S. soil and elsewhere around the world. Psychedelic drugs weren't the only item in MK-Ultra's toolkit, though. Other elements the program employed included things like electroshock therapy, paralytics, and other elements that were often administered at hospitals, prisons, and even at universities both in the U.S. and also in parts of Canada. Of course, the full extent of MK-Ultra will probably never be known. Such disturbing activities were at times intentionally kept off the books, and what records did exist were largely destroyed after the program ended in 1973. Now here I will mention, by the way, there have been some documents that have been released about MK-Ultra, some that were intended to have been purged somehow, maybe not by pure chance alone, I will add, did manage to survive after Richard Helms, then director of the CIA, and also one Sidney Gottlieb, had advised that they be completely destroyed, and that, of course, being a problem, because typically the destruction of documentation like that is against the law. Although in this case it was a little more complex because the efforts of those trying to cover up, back in the 1970s when all this was about to come to light, the illegalities of what the CIA and other intelligence agencies had been up to, they were doing everything that they could to make sure that if anything was destroyed, they wouldn't be held accountable for it under law. But a notable development in all of this, from just within the last few months, in fact, is that my colleague John Greenwald of the Black Vault, after several years going back and forth with government, managed to obtain additional files that had not been released previously through the Freedom of Information Act, and this related to MK-Ultra. I believe John has got all of those available there at the Black Vault website, so if you go to that website and you click the search bar, you just search for MK-Ultra, you can find the files that John has managed to obtain. This was big news when it came out, John really being a leader in that effort toward achieving greater transparency in government. But one of the things that has really made MK-Ultra so disturbing over the years is the way that it has utilized drugs in the furtherance of the efforts toward achieving mind control. We're going to get into that when we return here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Continuing our discussion about mind hacking, MK Ultra, and the efforts by U.S. intelligence agencies, often illegal ones, to try and make unwitting test subjects of American citizens. Now, where we left off, we were about to get into the discussion about the role that drugs played in all of this. I can think of no better place to start than the discussion of one man, Albert Hofmann, sort of a giant in the history of psychedelic substances, a Swiss-born chemist. He's arguably best known as the discoverer of lysergic acetylethylamide, or LSD. Hofmann was the first person to synthesize and later to learn the psychedelic effects of this substance, and in a very most life-changing way. In his book, LSD, My Problem Child, Albert Hofmann described his own strange experience of being lured back to the otherwise uninteresting synthesis of a useless drug that he had named LSD-25 while he was pursuing medically useful derivatives from the parasitic fungus ergot. And this has always fascinated me. It was a useless synthesis, and yet something, he said, kept calling him back to it. And I want to quote him here. "I could not forget the relatively uninteresting LSD-25. And he refers to it as a, quote, peculiar presentiment, the feeling that this substance could possess properties other than those established in the first investigations, induced me 5 years after the first synthesis to produce LSD-25 once again, so that a sample could be given to the pharmacological department for further tests." Now, briefly, that term presentiment, by the way, simply means an intuitive feeling about the future. In other words, he said there was something that he had, almost a bit of knowing, right? An intuition about LSD-25. Hofmann notes that this was all but forbidden in his practice, by the way. After all, experimental substances, as a rule, could not be resubmitted for what would amount to potentially costly testing, especially when they were understood already to be lacking in pharmacological interest. Hofmann followed his intuition in this case, and in the spring of 1943, he synthesized yet another batch of the peculiar LSD-25. It was around this time that Hofmann discovered LSD's strange chemical attributes. Somehow he had managed to get a very small amount of the stuff on his fingertips during the purification and crystallization process. Yeah. He described feeling a remarkable restlessness combined with a slight dizziness. The words of Hunter S. Thompson come to mind there. "I feel a little lightheaded." Well, later at home, he began to feel lightheaded, and he laid down, closed his eyes to block out the unpleasantly glaring light from outside, and was treated to an uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures, extraordinary shapes with intense kaleidoscopic play of colors, and this lasted 2 hours. Well, needless to say, Hofmann was an early convert to the mystical, magical properties of LSD. And it was only a matter of time, of course, before the CIA began to experiment with LSD as well. And when they did, it was only natural that this activity would be overseen by the agency's chemist and poison expert, Sidney Gottlieb. who is a key figure in this entire story. According to Stephen Kinzer, who's the author of Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control, that is a new book with one hell of a title. But Kinzer writes, he was given a ridiculously daunting assignment, Gottlieb that is, discover the secret of mind control. The CIA was looking for a truth serum, an amnesiac, and a way to program people to become spies, saboteurs, and assassins. Gottlieb's search, codenamed MKUltra, led him to conduct the most extreme experiments on human subjects ever sponsored by the U.S. government. MKUltra was one of the Cold War's deepest secrets, largely unknown even within the CIA. Kinzer says that, quote, as head of the MKUltra mind control project, Gottlieb directed brutal experiments at secret prisons on three continents. He made pills, powders, and potions that could kill or maim without a trace, including one intended for Fidel Castro and other foreign leaders. He paid prostitutes to lure clients to CIA-run bordellos, where they were secretly dosed with mind-altering drugs. However, like so many of the characters in this story involving psychological torture and even death, Gottlieb also had a strangely soft side, as Kinzer explains for us.
Most of the people in the early CIA were rich kids who were aristocratic silver spoon products of the same prep schools and investment banks and law firms. Sidney Gottlieb wasn't like that. He was 32 years old. He was the son of Jewish immigrants in the Bronx. Father owned a sweatshop. He had a limp. He stuttered. He was very different from everybody else that he came to work for on a Friday the 13th in 1951. And he was also different in another way, which was his private life. So he must have been unique, not only among CIA officers of the early 50s, but among all federal bureaucrats in Washington at that time. He was a kind of a proto-hippie. He lived in an eco-house in the middle of the Virginia woods that had no running water. He meditated with candles around him. He studied Buddhism. He grew his own vegetables. He milked his goats before dawn in the morning to make yogurt. So this person who wound up being the most prolific American torturer of his generation was also somebody who considered himself to be a deeply spiritual humanist. That alone makes him a particularly interesting person to have taken on this job.
Gottlieb was a mixed bag, to say the least. But under his oversight, studies with the MKUltra project were funded at high-profile American colleges like Columbia University, Stanford University, and others. Sometimes, I'll note, these facilities weren't fully aware of what actual studies were being conducted there. However, LSD wasn't the only drug the CIA had experimented with. MDMA, or ecstasy, mescaline, heroin, barbiturates, methamphetamines, and no doubt other substances were also used. Now, coming back to Albert Hofmann for a moment, because along with synthesizing LSD, he had also been the very first to synthesize psilocybin, that being the hallucinogenic agent in the magic mushrooms used by the Brujas of Latin America for ages, and, of course, which also soon became one of the focal points of the MKUltra program. And to further that point, we refer now to a 1979 ABC News broadcast, which was entitled Mission Mind Control, an audio soundbite from which, courtesy of the National Archives, provides some additional details. In this clip, Dr. James Moore is a chemist who assisted the CIA at that time, and what you are about to hear has always, to me, been one of the most telling and frankly amazing pieces of audio in relation to the entire dialogue since the revelations about MKUltra came to light. This is Dr. James Moore and what he had to say about the use of psilocybin and the implication that drugs like this might have been used against unwitting Americans.
What in the world were they looking for with the magic mushrooms?
I think the best answer to that is that they were looking for fundamental information on compounds that were would be capable of causing changes in behavior, changes in mental attitude.
Did you ever consider what would have happened if any of these substances were given to, say, unwitting people?
Oh, I don't remember having considered that specifically.
What if you... I trust perhaps you've thought about it.
Well, I haven't worried about it. Your question again, what would I have thought had I known that...
Any of these substances would be...
Would have been given to...
Unwitting persons.
You mean a hostile agent of another government?
No, well, I mean
that was probably one of the things they had in mind.
I mean testing it out on an American citizen.
I guess I must seem very, very cold-blooded about this, but I don't recall ever having been very much preoccupied with that issue.
Well, isn't that nice? If we ignore it, maybe we can pretend it never happened, and that no lives were ever affected by the work we did. Well, when we return, things get even stranger as we explore what was called Operation Midnight Climax, a more appropriate name for which might have been sex, drugs, and the CIA. That and much more in our pursuit of answers to the mystery of mind control await here on the Micah Hanks Program. Bunker below ground, which is a good place to be in 2020. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be your host and to have all you guys here along for the ride like we do every week. Hey, I've got to take a moment to remind you, if you aren't already an ex-subscriber, simply put, you're missing out. That's right. You guys need to sign up today if you want to get access to all the additional content, because we're going to go even further down this weird rabbit hole about MKUltra and mind control on the X podcast this week. Also, a brand new episode of Enigmas will be dropping here in just the next couple of days. Remember, as an X subscriber, you get every week an additional supplemental podcast, the additional edition, otherwise known as the X podcast. And you also get monthly specials, the Enigmas podcast, where we go in pursuit of the mysteries of this world in a slightly more theatrical way, which makes for great listening. But of course, don't forget you also have back access. That's right, access to the entire back catalog of our show, all the episodes, all of the subscriber content, and that going all the way back to 2013. All of you, of course, also get your own personalized RSS feed on which to be able to listen to that. So if you are going to become a new X subscriber right now, you aren't just getting a new show every week. You get back catalog access, and so all the more reason to sign up today if you have not already, because you've got a lot of catching up to do. Because if all you're getting are the public podcasts, the free shows, well, friends, you're only getting about half of everything we produce. Now, how do you sign up? Well, from right there in your podcast app, where you can find the now easily navigable chapters for every program. Well, just scroll down in the show notes and you will also see where you can sign up and become an X subscriber. We've got several areas where it is linked to make it easy to access for everybody, but you can also just head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast and click the X subscriptions there in the upper right hand corner. So access it from your app or from the World Wide Web. And while you are navigating through the show notes there available from your podcasting app, you may have also seen the advertise link. If you listen to this show and you would like to advertise on the Micah Hanks Program and reach thousands of people every week with your brand or your product, all you got to do is click that link that we offer right there in the show notes. That will hook you up with our partners at AdvertiseCast. They are fine folks to work with and they will get you where you need to be. And now let's get back into this story, because where we left off, we were about to dive into some discussion about the aptly named Operation Midnight Climax. Now, this was a project under the oversight of MKUltra that relied on prostitutes under the employ of the CIA, who would lure men to safe houses operated by the agency, and that allowed them to conduct drug experimentation on men who were brought there. Now you get it, don't you? Operation Midnight Climax. But wait, it gets even weirder. Because most of these experiments were carried out in San Francisco and New York, and it was a regular party. That according to the CIA agents who were running this. While the men brought home by these ladies of the night were secretly given doses of LSD, often what was happening was there were CIA agents observing from behind a two-way mirror. In many instances, they were drinking cocktails. In fact, according to one account, one CIA agent observer sat on a toilet seat while pouring martinis out of a pitcher. Remember, folks, those are your government dollars at work. The program, according to various sources, had little oversight, and the CIA agents involved admitted that a freewheeling, party-like atmosphere prevailed. Now, to offer a bit of background on this, there's an interesting article. I'm going to refer, by the way, to the sanitized copy approved for release by the CIA. This, I believe, appeared in the San Francisco Bee. Paul Avery writing back in August of 1977. And this article titled, Unknowing Patrons Were Given LSD. A central intelligence agency brothel set up here in the 1950s was actually a front for early experiments with LSD and other drugs. Avery reports that the CIA rented a one-bedroom apartment on Telegraph Hill in the spring of 1955, equipped it fully with microphones, opened it as a brothel, and then fed LSD and other drugs to the unsuspecting patrons of the prostitutes, the Bee has learned. Agents from the CIA and the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics were stationed in front of the apartment house at 225C Chestnut Street to photograph the uniformed human guinea pigs as they entered and left the brothel, a source close to the project said. Other agents stationed in a storeroom in the building monitored, tape-recorded, and transmitted the conversations and sounds picked up by the four microphones that were hidden in the rented apartment, the source said. The article goes on to say that the source did not know whether the $100-a-trick prostitutes, who were recruited by a narcotics agent posing as a hoodlum, were aware of the drug experiments or whether they, too, were being drugged and observed. Probably the latter is the most likely. But a former CIA psychologist, John Gittner, told a joint U.S. Senate committee hearing in Washington at least some of the hookers were aware of the experiment and were used to slip the drugs into drinks of their unsuspecting customers. Gittner, who testified that he had been to the San Francisco safe house, although they use a different word for it here, this was 1977, mind you, while it was in operation, said that they didn't know if any of these ladies of the night knew that they were working for the CIA. Interesting. Later in the article, though, they bring up the fact that the Bee has learned, however, that Morgan Hall, an individual who was associated with this so-called safe house, was a fictitious name adopted by none other than Colonel George White, then the director of the San Francisco Field Office of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. White is described in the article as an Office of Strategic Services agent in World War II, and was blocked from becoming a CIA agent after the war by J. Edgar Hoover, who considered White a publicity hound. White retired from the Narcotics Bureau in 1965 and became the fire marshal of Stinson Beach. He died on October 24, 1975. But about Mr. White, the man who ran several of those safe house operations was also a key figure in all of this. George Hunter White was born in 1906. He began his career as a journalist in San Francisco and in L.A., then in the 1930s, he began his work as a narcotics agent, as we heard in the article earlier, before joining the OSS during the war. While he was with the OSS, he actually attained the rank of lieutenant colonel, although he did go back to work in narcotics after the war. Also during the 1950s, he worked as an investigator for a Senate committee headed by Senator Estes Kefauver, which was investigating mob activities and organized crime. But that's not all he would do in the 1950s, because as early as 1952, White was in communication with Sidney Gottlieb about doing consultation work for the CIA, even if he was barred from actually becoming an agent. And we know this on account of diaries that White was keeping at the time, which were later made available to journalists. I now quote from Mr. White's journal, this dated June 9, 1952. Gottlieb proposes I be CIA consultant, and I agree. 1 year later, another entry here reads, CIA got final clearance and signed contract as consultant. Met Gottlieb, lunch, Napoleon's, met Anslinger. Now that's Harry C. Anslinger he's referring to. That was White's boss and the number one man in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, according to a Washington Post article from 1977. I further quote, it could not be learned from the diaries whether Anslinger knew that one of his top narcotics agents also was working for the CIA, in fact, and was tape recording and observing men whom prostitutes gave drugs after picking them up in bars. But a July 20th, 1953 entry by White strongly suggests that Anslinger did know. Here's another entry from White's diary, which seems to confirm this. Arrive in Washington, confer Anslinger and Gottlieb re CIA reimbursement for three men's services. Well, there you go. Now, John Jacobs and a freelance reporter, Paul Avery, in 1977, wrote for the Washington Post, these entries, referring to White's journals, fit in with a 1963 internal report by then-CIA Inspector General Lyman B. Kirkpatrick about the MKUltra project. That report, made public in 1975, discussed the safe house operations and the connection to the Bureau of Narcotics. Here I further quote from the article, TSD, Technical Services Division, entered into an informal arrangement with certain cleared and witting individuals in the Bureau of Narcotics in 1955, which provided for the release of MKUltra materials for such testing as those individuals deemed desirable and feasible. Now, there were all kinds of records there around 1977 that were forthcoming about the late Mr. White. One of these included a letter he had written to Dr. Harvey Powelson, who had been the chief of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California at Berkeley. And he had told Powelson at that time he worked for a, quote, rather obscure department of the government that would like to remain obscure, unquote. That department was, quote, then interested in obtaining some factual information, this according to the letter to Dr. Powelson, information and data on the use and effect of various hallucinogens, including marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol, and then the brand new LSD. I further quote from that letter, tests were made under both clinical and non-clinical conditions on both witting and unwitting subjects. Now, this is a theme that we begin to see and will continue to see with some of those who were monitoring the effects of these hallucinogenic substances on these unwitting test subjects. They would begin to see these effects and say, you know, I began to get kind of interested in trying it myself. White was no different. Quoting again from the letter to Powelson, so far as I was concerned, clear thinking was non-existent while under the influence of any of these drugs. He went on to say in the letter, I did feel at times that I was having a mind-expanding experience, but this vanished like a dream immediately after the session. Now, earlier we'd already heard in the audio soundbite from Mr. Kinzer, who has written the biography of Sidney Gottlieb, that there was this strange, softer side to this guy. Practicing yoga, growing vegetables, and the like. Well, we also see that with Mr. White, a guy who was more than happy to run safe houses where prostitutes were bringing men and where illegal drug experimentation on them was being conducted. But if we refer to his diary, we see all kinds of things not related to addicts and prostitutes that are listed. He records that Eisenhower and Nixon won the election in 1952. He recorded when the Brooklyn Dodgers took the National League baseball pennant in 1955 and even crafted an entry when his pet bird died. That occurred in 1952, presumably while he was waiting to find out if he would become a consultant to the MKUltra program. And when the bird died, he wrote, "Try it hard. I don't know if I'll ever get another bird or pet. It's tough on everyone when they die." Now, am I the only one who thinks it's a little bizarre when you see the human side of some of these characters? Gottlieb and his proto-hippie activities, and George White lamenting the death of a parrot while years later he would be administering LSD to unwitting patrons of prostitutes that were being supplied with addictive narcotics themselves by the CIA. As White recalled in 1971, of course, I was a very minor missionary, actually a heretic, but I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill and cheat, steal, deceive, rape and pillage with the sanction and blessing of the All-Highest? That's a direct quote. Now, in the 1977 Washington Post article we referenced earlier, White's diaries also indicated that Gottlieb continued to visit, flying out from Washington several times a year, at least until 1961. Another visitor, of course, was a name that we already heard from the San Francisco Bee reporting, John Gittinger, the CIA psychologist who had testified 1 month beforehand, before the Senate investigative committees, that he had met with this quote-unquote Morgan Hall, actually Mr. White, on numerous occasions to interview prostitutes about their drug and sex habits. But there was further reporting of interest to us in the Washington Post article from 1977, and I quote, "One interesting detail links White to the 1953 case of Dr. Frank Olson, an Army employee who was working with the CIA at Camp Dietrich, Maryland. He wasn't actually an Army employee at the time, but he's often referred to as having been such. Olson had been given LSD without being told, and 10 days later jumped to his death from the 10th floor of a New York City hotel. At the time, Lashbrook was in the room with Olson, who had gone to New York to be treated by Dr. Harold Abramson, a psychiatrist who had worked for the CIA. According to CIA documents, Lashbrook called Gottlieb, his supervisor at the time, and then went to the police station to identify the body. He was asked to, quote, turn out his pockets, unquote. He had apparently written on a piece of white paper the initials GW and MH. Now, what could that have meant? But of course, those initials seemed to match George White and Morgan Hall, who were in fact one and the same, Morgan Hall being George White's cover name. The piece of paper also contained the address 81 Bedford Street, which White's diary shows to have been the New York safe house. And a final connecting detail reported by the Washington Post had been that White apparently knew Abramson because a September 20th, 1954 diary entry contained a reference to Gottlieb and Abramson. Now, these connections might have seemed par for the course considering all of these men's involvement with the MKUltra program and its operations, but the concerning element that appears to tie them all together appears to hinge on the events surrounding the death of Frank Olson, which had been one of the most strange and tragic affairs not only in the history of MKUltra, but also maybe in the history of the CIA. And so when we return, we will be turning our attention to that aspect of all of this, right here on the Micah Hanks program. Mind Control Secrets of the CIA. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. And as we're delving into this, this is where things tend to get particularly dark. Because in addition to all of the unwitting participants who were American citizens, we also had certain employees involved with the agency and their operations at that time. Of course, Frank Olson, chief among these. Presumably, Olson couldn't have known when he attended a CIA retreat in 1953 that his punch had been spiked, and with more than just alcohol. A scientist who worked for the CIA, Olson also couldn't have known that in just a few days he would be the victim of an alleged suicide. Frank Olson seemed to be the model government employee. He was born in 1910 in Wisconsin, where he studied chemistry during his college years while enrolled in the university's Reserve Officer Training Program. Dr. Ira L. Baldwin, an agricultural bacteriologist, had encouraged Olson to obtain his Ph.D., and Baldwin would also be appointed, later as the first scientific director at Fort Detrick in 1942. And so when he arrived, he recruited Olson to work first at the Edgewood Chemical Warfare Arsenal, and then later brought him on over to Fort Detrick, which, by the way, was a massive biological warfare facility dating back to the years of World War II. Rumors had told that they were developing colored smoke for airplanes there, although what actually had been on the menu at Fort Detrick at the time had been closer to a banquet of the most exotic poisons that you could imagine, served with weapons and other technologies designed for their delivery. It had been on account of all this that the location earned its famous nickname, Fort Doom. Now, Olson's work there at Fort Detrick mainly dealt not with poisons, but with protective masks and clothing, things familiar to a lot of us these days in the era of COVID, as well as the improvement of their performance and their use in the study of biological warfare. In 1950, Olson became chief of the Plans and Operations Branch of the CIA's Special Operations Division, and there he served as a deputy to none other than Dr. Sidney Gottlieb. All roads lead to Gottlieb, don't they? Olson thereafter would visit European countries as part of his profession over the course of the next 3 years, receiving a diplomatic passport that allowed him to carry items in a diplomatic pouch, and in doing so he wouldn't be subject to searches by customs. And while he was in Germany, CIA official William King Harvey met with Olson to discuss a CIA program. This was known as Operation Artichoke. Very much in keeping with MKUltra, this program would also involve illegal drug testing. In fact, Olson's experience with drugs and chemicals from this period at Fort Detrick made him an asset to Artichoke, and it is believed that while in Germany and other European countries, Olson had probably witnessed or even may have participated in what were called terminal experiments. Some of these carried out on former Nazi SS officers and captured Russian double agents. Further allegations of drugs being slipped into the beverages of patrons at bars and cafes during this time also circulated. A tragic irony in the months leading up to Olson's own reckoning with fate. But Norman Cornoyer, a colleague of Olson's from back at Fort Detrick, was one of the ones who later, and this occurred in 2001, he recalled Olson having a tough time after Germany, his own words, and the experiences that he had there with, quote, drugs, torture, and brainwashing, unquote. According to Cornoyer, his friend from Fort Detrick seemed to have felt remorse for the kinds of things he had observed while he was in Germany, and it reminded him, in fact, of what concentration camp victims had endured during the war. Cornoyer wasn't the only person, apparently, who had been aware at the time of Olson's displeasure with his job. He'd apparently told his wife, Alice, that he had now felt he had made a, quote, terrible mistake, and also that he was contemplating leaving his job. However, this might not have been all that Olson meant when he said that he had made a terrible mistake, because Olson had apparently also admitted while under interrogation around that time that he might have breached some security protocols. One of the Artichoke employees that Olson had been working with was a guy by the name of William Sargent, a psychiatrist who advised British intelligence at the time, and Sargent called Olson a security risk. He had flatly stated that Olson had expressed similar misgivings about his work with the program to him as well, and that this, of course, made him a security risk. However, worst of all had been the fact that at least one of Olson's colleagues, according to journalist Stephen Kinzer, had said that Olson had been asking around among his colleagues and co-workers if anyone knew a good journalist. Now, what could that mean? Well, that was probably the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, and soon afterward a memo appeared in Olson's file which made note of the fact that it was now believed that he might have violated certain security restrictions. In other words, Frank Olson had become a liability, and now he had a target on his back. On November 28, 1953, Olson fell to his death from the window of a New York City hotel room. Michael Ignatieff, writing for the New York Times in 2001, described the scene rather vividly when he wrote, "On November 28, 1953, around 2 a.m., Armand Pastore, night manager at the Statler Hotel opposite Penn Station in New York, rushed out the front door on 7th Avenue to find a middle-aged man lying on the sidewalk in his undershirt and shorts. He was broken up something awful," Pastore told reporters many years later, "flat on his back with his legs smashed and bent at a terrible angle." Looking up, Pastore could see a blind pushed through an empty window frame high up on the Statler. The man had fallen from the 10th floor, apparently after crashing through a closed window, but he was alive. "He was trying to mumble something, but I couldn't make it out. It was all garbled, and I was trying to get his name." By the time the priest and the ambulance came, the stranger on the sidewalk was now dead. When Pastore went on to the stranger's room, 1018A with the police, they found a man who gave his name as Robert Lashbrook, sitting on the toilet with his head in his hands. Down at reception, Pastoria asked the hotel telephone operator whether she had overheard any calls from 1018A. Two, she said. In one, a voice had said, "He's gone." The voice on the other end replied, "That's too bad." Lashbrook admitted making two calls, but has denied saying anything of the sort. And that ends the quote from Ignatia from 2001. Now, the official cause of death was deemed a suicide, and it occurred just days after Olson had been given a cocktail laced with LSD. He had effectively gone from being one of the experimenters in Artichoke, and now had come full circle and served as one of the many unwitting guinea pigs for its successor, MK Ultra. An interesting footnote here, though, is the following entry from within a controversial CIA assassination handbook, an online copy of which can be found at the George Washington University National Security Archive webpage, the relevant portion from this, which I'm going to read for you, under a section titled Accidents, reads as follows. Quote, "For secret assassination, either simple or chase, the contrived accident is the most effective technique. When successfully executed, it causes little excitement and is only casually investigated. The most efficient accident in a simple assassination is a fall of 75 feet or more onto a hard surface. Elevator shafts, stairwells, unscreened windows, and bridges will serve. Bridge falls into water are not reliable. In simple cases, a private meeting with the subject may be arranged at a properly cased location. The act may be executed by sudden, vigorous, then there's a redaction, of the ankles tipping the subject over the bridge. If the assassin immediately sets up an outcry, playing the horrified witness, then no alibi or surreptitious withdrawal is necessary. In chase cases, it will usually be necessary to stun or drug the subject before dropping them. Care is required to ensure that no wound or condition not attributable to the fall is discernible after death." Can you believe this actually was ever written? Then again, if you aspire to carry out assassinations that you want people to perceive as being a suicide after the fact, might as well have a method behind it, right? Now, in 1994, Olson's surviving family requested a second autopsy. And at that time, forensics experts discovered injuries on his body that they believed would have had to have occurred prior to falling out that window. One of these had been what appeared to be an area of blunt trauma to the head, which was inconsistent with the position he was found in when he landed on the ground outside the hotel. And on account of some of these apparent discrepancies, it has led some to believe that Olson may not have simply fallen out of a window, nor had he necessarily committed suicide, even though we do know that he was given LSD just 10 days beforehand. No, some of the evidence does strongly suggest this was more akin to one of those covert assassinations. We'll wrap things up here as we continue our discussion of mind control and MKUltra here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back as we're concluding our conversation about MK Ultra and the mind hacking efforts of the CIA, a program that ran roughly from around 1953 until maybe as late as 1973. So for two decades, bear that in mind. The Central Intelligence Agency had been carrying out these covert studies, sometimes at universities and hospitals, both in the United States and in Canada. And they were exploring whether or not essentially a person's mind could be broken apart and thereafter controlled. And often, illicit substances were used in this process. Now, over the years, there were additional stories that would begin to come forward about the tests that were occurring with LSD and other drugs. According to an article at History.com, one of these had been Ken Kesey. And he was the author of the 1962 novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the film rendition of which I actually recently reviewed as part of the preparation for this episode. And Kesey had volunteered for MKUltra experiments with LSD while he was a college student at Stanford University. He later went on to promote the drug, hosting LSD-fueled parties that he called acid tests. Now, more on that in a moment, but what's kind of interesting is that Ken Kesey, after he was originally introduced to LSD, he thought this is great, and he tried to get all of his friends to go down there to the hospital and to also submit themselves for these trial studies. He later ended up actually getting a job there so that he could steal the LSD and give it to his friends. And all of these experiences, especially his time working there at the hospital in question, had been sort of the inspiration behind One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But returning to the History.com article, they note that acid tests combined drug use with musical performances by bands, including the Grateful Dead and psychedelic effects such as fluorescent paint and black lights. These parties influenced the early development of hippie culture and kick-started the 1960s psychedelic drug scene. Other notable people who reportedly volunteered for CIA experiments with LSD included Robert Hunter, the Grateful Dead lyricist, Ted Kaczynski, better known as the Unabomber, and James Joseph Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston mobster. Boy, if confirmed, that would really explain a lot, wouldn't it? But of course, these experiments are reasons why, many years later, John Lennon, the former Beatle, and pop icon of the 1960s, had said of the LSD movement, if you want to call it that, hey, we have the CIA to thank for that. Now, in December 1974, a big change occurred, and this involved the publication of a story on the front page of the New York Times written by Seymour Hersh, and it detailed the CIA's illegal, non-consensual drug experimentation on unsuspecting Americans. It was entitled, Huge CIA Operation Reported in U.S. Against Anti-War Forces. And for New York Times subscribers, because I do believe it's in their archives and hence behind a paywall, we'll have that linked in the show notes. Although I'll tell you, I've read the entire article a couple of times. It only begins to barely broach the surface of what would later come to light with relation to the actual MKUltra program. But nonetheless, Hersh's article spurred three government investigations that would begin probing illegal activities being carried out by the U.S. intelligence agencies. And these, of course, were the Rockefeller Commission, the Church Committee, and the Kennedy-Inouye Select Committee hearings. The activities these committees investigated ranged from general spyfare like wiretapping and tampering with mail of U.S. citizens to, yes, the unwitting drug testing that was underway within the purview of the MKUltra program. Precautions must be taken to conceal these activities from the American public in general, this according to a 1957 internal evaluation of MKUltra by the CIA's Inspector General, and this was revealed during the Church Committee's final proceedings. To further quote from the document, the knowledge that the agency is engaging in unethical and illicit activities would have serious repercussions, unquote. You think? A review from the Inspector General in 1963 added, quote, a final phase of the testing of MKUltra products places the rights and interests of U.S. citizens in jeopardy. Yeah, understatement of the century. Well, things were finally coming to a head. Watergate was fresh on Americans' minds. And as Hersh noted in his bombshell New York Times piece, quote, Senator Howard H. Baker Jr., Republican of Tennessee, who was vice chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee, has publicly spoken of mysterious CIA links to Watergate. The White House transcripts of June 23, 1972 show President Nixon saying to H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, quote, well, we protected Helms from one hell of a lot of things, unquote. Now, that statement certainly caught Hersh's attention, of which he wrote, the remark, commented upon by many officials during recent interviews, could indicate presidential knowledge about the CIA's alleged domestic activities. He further wrote that the possible Watergate link is but one of many questions posed by the disclosures about the CIA that the Times sources say they believe can be unraveled only by extensive congressional hearings. Well, the following year, President Ford set up the United States President's Commission on CIA Activities within the United States. This commission began to investigate the CIA's illegal activities, which included the MKUltra program. The Church Committee, so named for Democratic Senator Frank Church, who headed the commission, became an even more expansive investigation into the U.S. intelligence agencies and their illegal activities, and that was particularly focused on the time during and shortly after the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Well, what the committee found, needless to say, was startling. They discovered evidence of plots to assassinate Fidel Castro, as well as a plan which similarly targeted Congolese independence leader Patrice Lumumba. Not least among the Church Committee's findings had been thousands of documents, those which weren't destroyed beforehand. And yes, they pertained to the CIA's MKUltra program. Now imagine that you'd heard nothing about illegal drug experiments being carried out on unwitting American citizens, and you're investigating the possibility that the United States intelligence community had been breaking the law, and maybe even endangering citizens. And in that process, you stumble onto this trove of documents explaining how the CIA carried out such activities, and these are only the ones that weren't purged, that is, illegally destroyed. The result of these bombshell discoveries would be a 1976 executive order on intelligence activities spearheaded by then-President Ford. Quote, "The purpose of this order is to establish policies to improve the quality of intelligence needed for national security, to clarify the authority and responsibilities of the intelligence departments and agencies, and to establish effective oversight to assure compliance with law in the management and direction of intelligence agencies and departments of the national government." That according to Section 1 of the order. Now, skipping ahead, in a section titled Restrictions on Experimentation, Ford's executive order also states that, quote, "Foreign intelligence agencies shall not engage in experimentation with drugs on human subjects, except with the informed consent, in writing and witnessed by a disinterested third party, of each human subject and in accordance with the guidelines issued by the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects for Biomedical and Behavioral Research." Needless to say, despite the changes that were instituted by the Ford administration, tremendous harm had already been done in terms of undermining American faith in their government. You know, we're supposed to show support for our government, but aren't they supposed to also show support for us? You know, we pay our taxes. Wouldn't we like to know that taxpayers' money is going toward illegal programs that actually endanger U.S. citizens, and in the case of those like Frank Olson, government employees who are actually killed, whether or not it was a suicide or an assassination? The truth remains that Frank Olson died, and that has remained one of many major sticking points in this entire affair of MKUltra. But we want to know that our government is working in our best interest and using the hard-earned dollars that we pay to it for things that we would endorse and condone. I don't think anybody could endorse or condone not only the illegal activities that were undertaken during the MKUltra years, 2 decades, mind you, but further add to the fact that those interested parties, including the so-called poisoner-in-chief Sidney Gottlieb, had actively worked to cover up what the CIA had been doing. They did everything in their power to make sure that the reality of MKUltra would never see the light of day. And in truth, what we are discussing is only the known aspects of it. The truth is, we will never know to what lengths these tests and those who were creating them would have gone. And as far as Sidney Gottlieb goes, trust me, it gets far worse. I mean, this guy, it's almost, in a strange paradoxical way, you could almost call him schizophrenic in the sense that here was a guy who was willing to poison people, who devised all of these horrible tortures, and yet at his retirement he also volunteered at children's hospitals, all kinds of stuff. In fact, he warrants so much more attention that when this conversation continues for ex-subscribers on the additional podcast this week, my main focus will be Sidney Gottlieb. We're going down that rabbit hole and also looking at that idea in addition to Gottlieb and his role in all of this. He was really sort of the main mastermind or the supreme architect behind MKUltra. But we'll also look at that idea of a so-called Manchurian candidate and what medical literature has to say about that. And so you might consider this main public podcast merely the hors d'oeuvres in a several-course meal, and of course we're going to be diving into the main course as far as Sidney Gottlieb's strange involvement in all this, and of course also what happened in the years after he worked with the CIA. That all awaits on the X podcast. But just a few closing considerations here. You know, you look at everything that was happening at that time, MKUltra, Watergate, etc. What do all these things do? We already pointed out that they help to undermine Americans' faith in their government, but what else does that cause? You know, we live in this era of fake news. Everybody's fact-checking everybody, and everybody is so concerned about what you can and cannot believe. But far less often do people ask the question, well, why are Americans prone toward conspiracy theories, unfounded rumors, and unconfirmed stories? Well, the reason why is because time and time again, we have learned that our government either botched investigations into things that actually happened, or they were involved themselves in covert operations that led to the deaths of Americans. We've talked about MKUltra here. We haven't even touched on COINTELPRO and things like that. And again, many sadly look at this today and they go, oh, conspiracy theories. These actual historical developments are also placed in the conspiracy theory camp, which, on the part of the skeptics who would say that, yet again shows their failure to understand the lessons that history teaches us. You know, the lessons, the stories, the documentation that these government agencies have released that absolutely confirm, however horrible it is, the truth of what we're talking about here. And it is often said, I believe this quote from George Santayana, that we study the past so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. And to paraphrase his quote, that is so very important because I see people who often seem to want to dismiss things as conspiracy theories because fundamentally what it really seems to be is that they are too uncomfortable with accepting how horrible these things are. They don't want to believe that these actually have a place in reality. But before we go and we condemn those who are prone toward belief in conspiracy theories, we should stop and ask ourselves, what has the government done to help quell the tendency for Americans to distrust their government? Unfortunately, history shows time and time again that they have failed in their job when it comes to supporting the ideal way of life for Americans, and our officials, both elected and those appointed in the bureaucracies behind the scenes, have failed in their fundamental mission to serve and protect. And programs like MKUltra offer a historical precedent for illegal activities carried out by our government, and not only against American citizens, but also by intelligence agencies that were traveling to other countries and doing the same thing there. Part of what had gotten under Frank Olson's skin to begin with, and which resulted in a target being on his back. But the final point is that these sorts of problems that we're examining here highlight the issues related to government secrecy. Because, of course, we see with the purge of documents related to the MKUltra program that the precedent exists that other programs, which for various reasons government agencies may wish to withhold information about from the public, certainly could also similarly go the way of the dinosaurs. And in fact, this has been strongly implied in a few instances. In fact, I mentioned John Greenwald earlier, who has worked diligently to try and get any additional documentation about MKUltra that existed, and actually did get a cache of documents that were eventually sent to him. But in many of his inquiries looking into the UFO issue, specifically looking at documents the NSA might have about that, yeah, John found, to his dismay, that after years of trying to get access to documents the NSA had about UFOs, after a few years, they began to just say, we don't have those documents, we did at one point, they've been destroyed. And although there are certain processes in various branches of the military, for instance, where some documents may actually be purged after a couple of years if they are not considered of historical importance or anything like that, in other instances, they are simply transferred to the National Archives, but there absolutely are some circumstances where information might be deemed less than significant and unworthy of being kept. Can the same be said, though, for experimentation on U.S. citizens or the observation of unidentified flying objects by members of our military? I mean, these things sound very important to me, And what we learn from the study of the MKUltra program is that this is one of those instances where, sure enough, there is historical precedent that supports the idea that some important information may be lost, namely because somebody wanted it to be lost, and that because the information in question made the government agency at fault look really bad. And so through the study of MKUltra and the intelligence agency's aims at trying to learn how to hack the human mind, I think we learn a much more important lesson. And that is, of course, that we as an active citizenry must always fight for greater transparency from our government. And sure, from time to time, there are such things as necessary secrets, which are in the furtherance of national security. But secrets just for secrecy's sake, and especially when they work against our best interests, are the very kind of thing that we must always be wary of. It's up to us in the end, and remember, ladies and gents, knowing is half the battle. All right, that'll be the final word for this week's edition of the program. As always, the show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Brager. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I remain yours truly, Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.